When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Warning, this podcast contains spoilers for actually nothing this time, but references to Foundation Season 2 airing now on Apple TV+. Hello, my name is Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Rosie Knight.
And welcome to X-Ray Vision, the Crooked Media podcast, where we dive deep into your favorite shows, movies, comics, and pop culture.
In this episode, Strike Watch. Then we're heading to Previously On for an SDCC scene report and a little talk about that Barbenheimer box office. In The Hive Mind, it's an interview with writer, producer, director David S. Goyer. And in The Nerd Out, some thoughts on Indiana Jones.
Coming up, Strike Watch. The historic double strike continues, and some updates here. Dwayne Johnson, who we have been tough on this podcast, has come up big. We talked about in the previous episode how important it is that the most powerful and successful members of the WGA and SAG have been in this fight to support, you know, some of the people who are on the lowest rungs of the ladder. And here's Dwayne Johnson, who has come through with a historic seven-figure donation to the SAG fund per Variety during the COVID-19 pandemic. The SAG-AFTRA Foundation worked to provide financial relief to many unions, 160,000 members via the foundation's Emergency Financial Assistance Program, which will again be used during the strike. And just in recent days, it has been announced that Dwayne made a truly historic donation to the fund.
Yeah, I think like you made a great point when we talked about the strike for the first time, which is like, this is the thing that makes us love comic books. It's like the people who are most powerful, who have the power, looking after the people who don't. And in this reporting, there was something really interesting, which I think sums up the power of why a union like this, when it works like this, is really, really great. Because it was saying that Courtney B. Vance, who's the SAG-AFTRA Foundation president and executive director Sid Wilson, actually wrote a letter to the 2,700 of the union's highest earning actors being like, look, we need money. Like, get, you're rich, give us money. And I'm like, that's exactly how it should be. And I love that Dwayne was the one who stepped up and was like, well, I'm giving seven figures, so who else wants to jump in? So I'm ready to see more rich people giving money to this. Because like you said, this is for the workers who are going to be in a situation where they're not going to make healthcare this year.
Yeah.
The $26,000 that they need to make annually is not going to happen. And that could even be if they were still working, that might have happened anyway with the way residuals are. So it's really great that this is happening. I love to see it.
George R. R. Martin, our good friend George R. R. Martin, has weighed in on the strike. The King, in his latest entry on his Not a Blog blog, he has weighed in on the strike, calling it, quote, the most important of my lifetime. He continues, no one can be certain where we go from here, but I have a bad feeling that this strike will be long and bitter. It may get as bad as the infamous 1985 strike, though I hope not. Now, of course, George has been a member of the WGA since the mid-80s. And he also continues with updates about House of the Dragon. Quote, House of the Dragon is shot mostly in London. a little bit in Wales and Spain and various other locations, which is why filming has continued. The actors are members of the British Union Equity, not SAG-AFTRA, and though Equity strongly supports their American cousins, British law forbids them from staging a sympathy strike. If they walk, they have no protection for being fired, breach of contract, or even sued. That's
terrible. Terrible law. It's really strange, too, because England has a history, like as George actually says in this blog, one of the major two parties is called the Labour Party, is built on the idea of protecting workers, but that has changed as the parties move more centrist. And it's really interesting because the subways in England, we call it the Tube, right? They have an incredibly powerful union, the transport workers, and that the fact that their union is so powerful has kind of been used to turn union sentiment in the public to be like, oh, well, they're getting it and you're not. When the big reminder that we all have about unions is, if you see someone in a job and you see them getting good benefits and going on strike to get better pay and they get paid better than you, don't ask why they're getting that. Ask why you're not going on strike to get it, you know? So it's kind of that thing. Yeah, I was actually even shocked, even though I knew the union protections weren't strong. I didn't realize they were, you can get fired and sued by HBO Max if you walk.
Nuts.
Not strong.
Absolutely nuts.
Also, wait, I just want to say as well, because this is a great, this is shows how scared the studios are right now. George R. R. Martin, his overall deal with HBO was suspended
on
June 1st, which they're doing with a lot of people, but you don't expect him to be one of them.
I think they're doing it. I will say it seems like they're doing it with everybody. They're taking the opportunity to not pay people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a significant calendar date coming up in August sometime, which is the I'm not sure of the exact day, but it will be the point at which contractually the studios have the opportunity to cancel some overall deals completely.
Wow.
By claiming force majeure, as this happened last time, and you would expect them to do it this time. You know, one of the talking points you hear is, oh, the studio actually likes this early part of the strike because they want to save money. They want to get rid of deals that aren't performing. I'm sure George will not be among those who are whose deals are canceled. But I think everybody everybody on an overall is not.
Yeah,
is
they're
not
cost cutting.
That check clear. And some of them may be done away with in the coming weeks. SAG approvals. SAG has granted approval for 39 productions to continue during the strike, including two films from the artistic darling studio A24. The list includes two projects from A24's independent production company. The titles are Mother Mary, starring Anne Hathaway and Michaela Cole, and Death of a Unicorn, starring Paul Rudd and Jenny Ortega. SAG has kind of signaled that indie projects that aren't, you know, they were... they're going to like forensically look through their accounting, but anybody that's not taking money from the studios and is not going to be distributed by any of the major players is truly an indie movie. And as in the case with A24, studios who agree tacitly to the WGA and SAG's demands, it says we'll go by what your proposals are now. We'll just willingly do that, are allowed to continue shooting. So if A24 can do it, why can't the rest of them?
Yeah.
We'll see where this goes.
Yeah. Have you been on the picket line, obviously. What's the feeling been on this? Because I've seen it's been quite controversial. Some people are like, A24 are doing it. That's amazing. But some people are also like, well, this is giving the biggest name actors paid work when people are out on strike who are kind of the lowest rung workers who are really need that money.
It's a little bit of a wait and see. I think everybody understands the idea, which is one, support the independent producers out there, truly independent film, number one, which is just a good thing to do. And number two, try and create these divisions by saying, hey, if you agree to our proposals, we can start filming right away. Like, who else wants to come in? You know, that's how notably the agency campaign from a few years ago, which I won't delve into, but part of how that eventually resolved is, the studios one by one saying, okay, fine, we'll work with you. Mm-hmm. If they can peel off some of the members of the AMPTP, that's all for the good. Mm-hmm. That said, I think that there is there's also some, okay, well, let's see how this goes, because I thought the idea was we're not working and we're not working. So we'll see.
Yeah.
The AMPTP released a 23-page document a few days ago. We're recording this on July 25th. They released this document on July 21st, and it had their version of the, I guess, last few negotiation rounds with SAG-AFTRA, their proposals and counter-proposals. You can find that in various places, but the Hollywood Reporter had a good write-up of it. But there's one thing that I wanted to... So one of the things that, of course, has been a sticking point is the issue of revenue sharing, you know, aka residuals, which is how many writers and actors, you know, keep the lights on when they're not, you know, in the months, often, you know, significant amount of months between jobs. And the AMPTP's position is that they don't want to pay them.
Exactly.
They don't want to pay those anymore. You know, they say, well, the business has changed. You know, tech has come in, Netflix, Apple, and Amazon, and they have different cultures. Their culture is based on secrecy. They don't want to give up the streaming numbers. Any kind of revenue sharing, sharing in the success of a project would necessarily involve the sharing of the viewership numbers, and they don't want to do that. So in their kind of counter to SAG's revenue sharing proposal, the AMPTP statement says, quote, "The union is proposing that performers share in the rewards of a successful show without bearing any of the risk. The union proposes to share in success, but not in failure. That is not sharing." One, this is the way it's been done in the past. Yes, of course. Like the actors are not putting up their own money and mortgaging their houses so that, like, you know, the project can go through. That said, throughout the entire history of TV, this is basically how it's been done. It's been understood. Yes, of course, the studios are making the capital investment, but anything that succeeds beyond, you know, a certain set point, then it's time to share in the wealth. And the AMPTP now says, well, that's the old thinking. We're not going to do that anymore. I don't think that the unions should accept that. But number two, this idea that because the actors are not taking on a form of, like, scaled capital risk is actually completely wrongheaded. First of all, a lot of this is a fight on for actors and writers to be able to, one, make their year, which is something that's gotten harder and harder. Making your year essentially means making enough money through the guild, through guild work, to qualify for health insurance. Now, anybody who has struggled to figure out, like, where's my health insurance coming from? How am I going to get it? Can I keep it? What am I going to do? Understands that, like, living in a world in which, one, you're trying to make it as either an actor or a writer, and two, trying to figure out, okay, do I need to get some kind of straight job in order to get benefits? You're taking a risk in your life just going out of the house without health insurance and trying to get it. One. Two, the amount of a large part of this struggle is about the amount of free work that goes on in this industry, whether it's actors spending their own money and time to send in a self-tape, which, you know, part of the complaints that actors have is these self-tapes are becoming more and more intricate with, like, lighting and, like, scenes. And now it's like not everybody has the resources to do this. All of which is to say actors and writers take on significant risk. It's not capital risk in the same way that the studios do, but they take on plenty of risk. And they should absolutely share in the success of a project when it succeeds.
Yeah, completely. And also, I mean, that you talk about self-tapes. I also saw that there's been a movement for people to get paid for auditions, because legally and contractually, you are supposed to be paid for
an
audition.
They're supposed to already.
But that hasn't been happening for a really long time. So even these base protections that you would hope these actors are getting for this alleged small investment of time that they're giving, the studios haven't been paying them anyway.
That's right. The strike continues, and we'll be covering it here on X Revision. Up next, previously on.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks,
Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between award-winning mattress brand Leesa and home design favorite West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is the culmination of these two companies' shared values: premium materials, meticulous craftsmanship, and sustainable practices. Made with natural latex, responsibly sourced natural wool, and environmentally safe foams, the Natural Hybrid elevates your sleep sanctuary. Indulges your senses and supports a greener tomorrow. Plus, when you purchase the Natural Hybrid, you're also helping fuel Leesa's work with shelters and those in need. Since 2015, Leesa has donated more than 40,000 mattresses to ensure children and families have a safe place to sleep. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Leesa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit leesa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.
It was SDCC, just gone. Our first SDCC since Twilight took over Hall H and invented Hall H culture, that there hasn't been a major studio presence inside the convention. Because I will say, when you go to San Diego, they always have activations. They have things that people can do without tickets. You can sign up online. And there were still a few of those. I believe FX turned up. I believe Hulu turned up with that kind of stuff. But inside, there were no major Hall H panels. There was no DC movies. There were no Marvel movies. There weren't even any big TV panels aside from a couple of little premieres where there wasn't any talent, apart from maybe a director who was able to turn up. But I have to say, San Diego was bumping. It was incredibly busy. Tiffany Babb, who's an incredible pop culture journalist and comic book journalist at Popverse, did a great write-up about how she spoke to lots of different retailers.
Yeah, I read that.
Yeah,
it was great.
Like Silver Sprocket, one of our favorite indie publishers, they said they had their biggest preview night ever. And preview night's usually a pretty quiet night, mostly for industry folks. Yeah. I spoke to multiple different exhibitors who said it was the biggest year they'd had. Quirk Books was also quoted in Popverse.
Yeah.
So basically what happened...
Funko, I believe, had
a
historic...
Also, the Marvel booth. They had had like a Marvel merch booth there that apparently did really, really well. Basically what happened was, because people were not in the Hall H queue lines, and there were not 6,000 people in Hall H, they were on the show floor. And you know what I have to say? They were also in the panel rooms. I did three panels, all of which were busier than most panels I've ever done. But the one that really stuck out to me, and I think this is representative of a lot of people's experience, I did a panel with Webtoon called A Golden Age for Women in Comics. And the idea was to highlight that women have always been making comics, but they've just been erased from the narrative. And now, thanks to Webtoon, thanks to incredible indie publishers like Black Jersey Press, the publisher Jimmy LaRouza was on the panel, women are being recognized for making comics, even though they've always been here. That is the kind of panel I've done at San Diego before about like disability or about different aspects of representation. And you get an eager crowd, but not a necessarily packed room, right? Those rooms can hold like 200-300 people. Our Golden Age of Women in Comics panel, which did feature Rachel Smythe, who makes Lore Olympus, who is arguably one of the most famous cartoonists in the world. So I'm giving her credit for how many people came as well. But that was a one-in, one-out panel. It was standing room only, and they had a queue outside to let people in. And I started to hear the other people. There was a queer horror panel, and that was the same thing, where they had a queue outside. So what happened with Hall H not being there is it drove people into the show floor. It drove people into the convention center. And the coolest thing is people just were excited. The vibes were great. I didn't see anyone who was disappointed or who wasn't prepared for the fact this was going to be comics focused. And it was just a really wonderful experience. Also, I will say there was a lot of great strike support. There was lots of cosplayers with strike signs. Actually, like Duncan Crabtree Island came on Saturday to speak on a panel about AI and voice acting and kind of advocate for the voice actors. And there were people giving, I know Danny Fernandez, one of our friends of the pod, she was giving out a lot of strike pins. And one of the coolest things was they had these signs that were like SAG signs, and they said, support the strike, carry this sign. And people would just hand them off to each other. So you'd see like Deadpool carrying it, and you'd see, and it really kind of opened my eyes to the fact, we obviously care about this stuff like deeply, not just because we're involved in it, but because it's something that we care about. We care about it because we love comics. We care about it because we love TV and movies. We want people to get paid. I don't think the studios realize how widespread that mentality is, that you can have a kid in a comics accurate Deadpool cosplay, because there was a lot of comic accurate cosplay because people didn't want to do movie cosplay because they felt like they were supporting Strux Studios. It was really heartening not only to see the love for comics, but also to see people recognizing that they understood why this SDCC was different. It was really cool. And I would say, if I was in charge of SDCC, I'd be having very different meetings with the studios next year. Like, how can you help us? If you want this platform, we don't need it. But if you want the platform of being on Hall H, how much are you going to invest in the convention? How much can we use this, your resources, to make this an even better place for comics, for the museum, for artists who can't afford an artist alley table? Because the truth is, Hall H not being there did not impact how that show was.
That's right.
Aside from positively for smaller press and artist alley people who felt like they, especially by the end of the weekend, I heard that Saturday and Sunday, it was almost like on the first 2 days, folks were walking around kind of being like, okay, I've never really been on the show floor. What am I going to buy? Like budgeting it out like you kind of do. And apparently Saturday and Sunday, those sales just went absolutely crazy.
That's great. That's great. And it's, you know, it's interesting now, I'm kind of reflecting on the fact that certainly in the Hall H era, I have never, never once heard someone talk about the kind of Hall H culture and the immense lines and what it takes to get in there with any kind of warmth.
No!
You know, it's
people
like,
people don't want to queue out there for two nights.
It is only complaints about the whole rigmarole of getting through that. And it's nice to see that there was almost like a turn the clock back moment of this, the energy and the community is still here. It's not going anywhere. And to your point, maybe there is a conversation about like what the relationship it will be in the future between the studios and Comic-Con. And hopefully that conversation can make the experience of Comic-Con kind of just better.
Yeah. And you make a great point, because I think something that was really special. So Dorian Parks, who's really great, who's a host and a kind of journalist in the same space as us, he moderated the Spider-Man 2 panel, which was about the video game, right? But what was really interesting was it was in Hall H, and so many people who would never have got to experience Hall H got to experience it because that wasn't necessarily the 2 day wait. So I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned. And the thing that made me the happiest was that my worst case scenario was like, people won't come, or they will come and they'll be really mad, and it will affect the people who've invested thousands of dollars, who are indie cartoonists, who know that this is the time that they can make the bag that weekend. That can be the one show you do that really makes you money. And it turns out it was the complete opposite. And it was just an absolute delight to be there. And because people were on the show floor and there weren't Hall H lines, San Diego was actually pretty chill to walk around. So yeah, it was overall just wonderful. And I'm hoping that we learn a lot of great lessons and kind of see them come into play more as we go ahead.
Up next, let's quickly talk about the insane Barbenheimer weekend.
Wild.
Okay, so Barbenheimer weekend has come and gone. Barbie is currently at 160 plus million and climbing. Oppenheimer as well is around 80 million-ish and climbing. Both movies are handily beating their projections. And the movies are back, folks. Here's my manager, Kenny, who you know, has been endlessly roasting me because I was not able to get into either movie. I really tried. My usual move is Friday morning or Saturday or Sunday morning, I'll take in a matinee
Whatever the new movie. Nostalgia.
Wonderful matinee for whatever the new movie is. I tried every movie time for mm-hmm. both movies. And there was like nothing except for like the front row seats at an IMAX where you're sitting basically
under
the screen.
And you can see 1 foot of the screen.
And you're my fucking vertebrae will snap in half because like my head is completely like looking up at the top of the screen. And I just couldn't do it. But two huge movies, obviously a marketing bonanza. And one of those things, a counter-programming coup in which both projects have been burnished by this entire scheme, part of which is just like the overall pettiness of Warner Brothers. So, you mm-hmm. know, one of the things that has happened in the past that led up to this is Christopher Nolan, among many filmmakers, was upset with Warner Brothers' move to take movies out of theaters, only give them a short run in theaters, and then put them right on Max, right? He's a lover of movies. He wants movies to be seen in the movie theater, and he didn't like that. So he left his longtime home, Warner Brothers. And as a kind of like pettiness, I guess, they were like, oh, yeah, well, we're going to have our movie, a Barbie, open opposite Oppenheimer when you do Oppenheimer at your new place. And guess what happened? Both movies are succeeding through this mm-hmm. because the Barbenheimer phenomenon has become a thing.
Yeah, I mean, I read a really interesting interview with like the head of global marketing from Warner Brothers, and it used some terms I'd never really heard of. So there's like, you know, obviously paid advertising, right? Which is paid marketing, yeah. which I have to say Warner Brothers did an unbelievable job of. Like they did the weirdest, coolest shit. Like they did an Architectural Digest video tour of the Malibu Dream House, yeah. like Barbie Dream House. Like yeah. they just did really weird stuff that kind of hit in the shitpost era of the internet that we're really in. Yeah. But he also talked about earned marketing, and that's essentially what Barbenheimer comes under the umbrella yeah. of, which is organic internet, like fun, like people getting excited. Yeah. And I mean, this is one of those wild moments where like neither of the studios saw this coming. Warner Brothers had Barbie tracking.
No way.
They had Barbie tracking at 75 mil and Oppenheimer was tracking for Universal at like 50 mil.
These movies
made $500 million globally over this weekend.
$500 million.
That doesn't exist without all the people online who made memes. It doesn't exist without people like Super Yaki making t-shirts in the Barbie font that say, do you guys ever think about dying? It doesn't exist without the incredible artists who made Barbenheimer mashup posters. Like one of our Discord fans and friends, like Rodrigo, he runs this film magazine called Layered Butter, and they did a Barbenheimer poster that went totally viral, and it is now basically used as almost as if it was an original official piece of art that both the studios made. They didn't. Neither of them could ever have imagined that these two ridiculously juxtaposed movies would create this fandom. But I also think that comes from Nolan being an auteur, Gerwig being an auteur,
yeah.
and this kind of hilarious dichotomy between like this serious, talky, three-hour biopic, which by yeah. the way, should never have been able to make 80 million. That's a superhero movie opening weekend.
It's truly insane. Yeah,
and then Barbie, which should be a flop that later finds a cult following, kind of like, you know, Gem and the Holograms, though that has found less of a cult following, but something like Josie and the Pussycats, right? Like that's yeah. kind of where people expected Barbie to land. So Barbie is now the biggest opening weekend of the year, beating Super Mario, which by the way had a ridiculous opening weekend.
I mean,
also beating Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. Also now the biggest opening weekend ever for a female director, beating both Wonder Woman and Captain Marvel. So beating two superhero movies. Also, in the international box office, Barbie almost made $200 million over this weekend. And I have yet to see Barbie because try seeing that in San Diego on SDCC yeah. weekend. People were not busy at SDCC. And today, obviously, bargain day at AMC. Good tip there if you want to save some money. $7 to see a movie. I looked, going with friends who work in the OC, and I looked from every theater from like Irvine down to LA, and it was almost impossible to find a ticket that was not in the front like three rows. Like, this movie's going to keep making money. The drop for Barbie from Saturday to Sunday was 9%, which is basically unheard of. And Oppenheimer's was also really low, by my understanding. So I think that the Barbenheimer weekend is over, but the Barbenheimer summer is not over. Like, sorry to the Haunted Mansion, but you're not touching either of these movies this weekend.
You know, you just know that right now there is an entire floor of people who work for like Apple Studios marketing who are trying to figure out who Napoleon's Barbie is.
Exactly. Like, no, this is what I'm saying.
How do we do this?
How upset do you think every studio is right now that they can't be on the phone to like every screenwriter and every director being like, so do you want to do like Street Sharks? Is it like, can you think of like an A24 take on like Street Sharks? Those meetings would be happening if the strike was not on. And I know they're all sitting there stewing in their juices, writing things like Gritty Polly Pocket. Like trying to find ways that they can do this. I love that. What is Napoleon's Barbie? Yeah, I am ready.
Can we rush an indie Carmen Sandiego movie to the theaters in time for Napoleon?
She's gotta go. You know, I feel like those conversations are happening. And, you know, this is one of those things where the real truth is there really a lesson here? It's hard to know because counter-programming has always worked. This is organic. You can't really replicate it. But the lesson that studios are going to learn is like toy movies, but with like an auteur director. And also I guess biopics can make a lot of money now if they're programmed against something like that. So yeah, I did see, I don't think it was a coincidence that yesterday they announced that Ryan Reynolds is rebooting Biker Mice from Mars. So I think we're going to see that. What we've been seeing as the IP rush for comics, I think we're going to see that moving back to toys, which it hasn't been for quite a long time. So that'll be interesting. I'm sure we're going to get many terrible toy movies, but maybe some good ones too.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Transformers is out here. G.I. Joe has been out here.
Yeah.
Lego has been out here. The toy movies have been doing well. It'll be interesting to see what's next.
But this is the first one that's come
close.
This
is a culture movie.
Yeah.
This is the culture.
This isn't the top fourth opening weekend of all time, only beaten by The Force Awakens, Infinity War, and Endgame. So now toys are in that. They're in that superhero movie space. And it beat Transformers Dark of the Moon as the biggest movie based on a toy. So yeah, toy movies are back, baby, for better or for worse.
Up next, our interview with David S. Goyer.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Tired of restless nights? Meet Lisa, the sleep expert. Here at Lisa, we know that good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. That's why their mattresses are made for exceptional comfort and support, catering to every sleep need. Check out Lisa's Sapira Hybrid Mattress, named Best Hybrid Mattress 5 years running. Sleep hot? The Chill Collection is built with cool-to-the-touch top fabric and layers of high-density comfort foams, all intended to remove excess body heat while maximizing comfort. With Lisa, getting a new mattress has never been easier. Delivery is free, and you have 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. Don't spend another night dreaming of better sleep. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus 2 free pillows. Go to lisa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. That's leesa.com/iHeart. Exclusions apply. See lisa.com for more details.
Welcome to The Hive Mind, where we explore topics with an expert guest. Today, we're thrilled to welcome writer, showrunner, and director David S. Goyer to discuss his career, creative process, and foundation.
David, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm a fan, and I was happy to return the favor because you co-host that other podcast you and I do.
And it is a delight to do it.
Yeah.
So how is your summer going?
Well, you know, I was filming something and we got shut down because of SAG, and I was over in Europe and we got shut down early Saturday morning, and then I booked a flight on my phone right there and went back to my hotel and packed and got on a plane about 5 hours later. And then I picketed in LA yesterday in 95 degree nice. Heat. But it's a crazy once in a lifetime situation yeah. and completely justifiable. But I'm also, you know, after spending the bulk of my last 4 years over in Europe, I'm really grateful to have this time with my family and not yeah. during a pandemic. So that's the silver lining for me.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about that? The obviously this strike is another bit of complexity and challenge on top of everything. That's and it impacts everyone industry wide. But like what the show that you were making is so grand and complicated. You just mentioned that you were in Europe for a lot of the last couple of years. Tell us about some of the challenges that you went through producing that.
I mean, Foundation's the most complicated project I've ever worked on. And we don't film it in sort of a volume of VFX box like some of the shows out there. We film more than half the show on location. In season one, filmed in 6 different countries. I think season 2 filmed in 5 different countries. We do what we call cross-boarding, meaning like the schedule gets, we don't film one episode and then another. Everything gets put in a blender. It's incredibly difficult. And it would have been difficult even without a pandemic and multiple strikes, but it's just, we just keep, you know, we had the initial lockdown and then season 2 lockdown wasn't happening, but we actually had many more delays because of COVID than in season 1, because in season 1, everyone was in a bubble, so-called bubble. Mm. We would take right. over hotels and we would charter flights and it's just like the hits keep coming and coming and coming and coming. And it's also crazy because it's the show's so wildly ambitious and I'm so grateful to have made the first 2 seasons, but like all of the changes, the seismic changes that are happening to our industry are like, I worry they're the very things that will make a show like ours not possible anymore. So who knows, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of things that from the very inception of adapting Foundation, you're in a situation where it's going to be a challenge, because there's many things over the years that have been called unfilmable.
Sure.
But this is probably like one of the most
unfilmable
things. Yeah. So like, what was the origin of you wanting to adapt it, or what was your origin with Asmos Foundation and kind of how this came to become a TV show?
Okay. I'll answer that, but I realize I should qualify. I'm speaking to you in the capacity as a director, because I've directed episodes 2 and 3 of the show. And not only am I allowed to promote in that capacity, I've been encouraged to promote by one of the 2 guilds I'm involved in. But what was it like? I mean, I was given the book by my ne'er-do-well father when he was 13, or I was 13. Not him, he was 13. He said, this is the greatest science fiction book of all time. You should read it. And I didn't read it because I was angry at him. And I think I read it in my 20s, and I got some of it, didn't understand what the big deal was, reread it in my 30s. And then over the years, because for the first 2 decades of my career, I was writing almost exclusively features. I was offered the opportunity to adapt it a couple of times. Once with Warner Brothers and once with Sony. And even then I just thought, people were thinking, we want to do a trilogy of films. And I just didn't think it was possible to condense all of that. It's anthological in nature. A lot of the stuff's been strip mined, you know, by Star Wars and Dune. And how do you make it new again? And so I said no a couple of times. And over the years, just like everyone, I would hear, this person or that person is trying to adapt it. And Also, I'm not sure I was a sophisticated enough writer to have adapted it earlier on in my career. But then maybe, I don't know, 5 years ago, streaming had started and people were suddenly tackling these big novelistic projects and saying, okay, now you've got at least 10 hours or 20 or 30. And then it seemed like it might be possible. And I'd had enough weighty adaptations under my belt to be crazy enough to try. But what was crazy was I was wading into adapting Foundation at the same time I was wading into adapting Sandman. But another famously unfilmable project. And I just thought it was just so surreal. And I'd flirted with Sandman for more than a decade as well. And it was, they both sort of came together at the exact same time. And then it just was a race. I was meant to run either one of them. And it was just a race as to which one was going to be greenlit first. And Foundation was. So then after working on the initial adaptation, with Neil and then Alan Heinberg took over that. But I don't know, did that answer your question? I got lost in my answer.
Yeah.
By the way, I heard you, Rosie, describe me as a friend of the pod on one of your podcasts the other day. And I'm honored to be considered a friend of the pod, although you and I have never spoken prior to this. So,
you know what? Jason's friends, my friends, pod friends.
You mentioned that you didn't think that maybe you were a sophisticated enough writer when you first.
Some people would argue I'm still not, by the way.
What is it about your writing evolution that you think has made you able to take on that project at that particular time? What had changed? What had you learned?
I think that, I guess over my career, I started to become the sort of one of the go-to guys to adapt, to take on like weighty IP or complicated IP. And I just remember, I think one of the things that changed was when Chris Nolan and I were working on Batman Begins, and we had this very methodical approach to Batman in which we would just, before we even came up with a story, we spent weeks just talking about what makes Batman, Batman. And so writing lists of the things that we felt were like essential Batman tropes, and then things that don't make Batman, Batman. And then this was crazy at the time, but we flew to New York and we met with all the editors of DC for 3 days and we asked them the same questions. And they said no one in all the decades prior to that had ever even asked DC what made Batman, Batman. And we just thought it was a no-brainer to do it. And so then we, before we even came up with the story, we just thought, okay, have we identified the core DNA of this thing? Do we have it right? And the editors at DC, Paul Levitz and people like that at the time, even Neil Adams, who we talked to, felt that we had gotten it right. And then we started building our story. Mm. And so what's amazing to me is how many people don't do that. And so that is an approach that I've just applied then to everything I've worked on over the last two decades, is just try to figure out, can I, you know, what makes this thing unique? And can I tell a story that doesn't betray those elements? And it sounds simple, but it's amazing. You know, I've talked about this before, but like I had this feeling, like with a lot of superhero adaptations, that they'll think about, okay, what villain are we going to use? And then build a story around it, as opposed to figuring out what makes, you know, superhero X, superhero X, and then figuring out what's the right villain to tell that story. So Chris and I did not decide we were going to start with Ra's al Ghul or the Scarecrow. We were going to tell this story about Batman overcoming his fears, or Bruce Wayne overcoming his fears and having all these daddy issues. And so fear led to Scarecrow, and daddy issues led to Ra's al Ghul, who was one of the only villains. Yeah, that was like more parental. And so I guess the approach was just very holistic in that way. And we applied the same things to Sandman. And in the case of Sandman, we had Gaiman with us, and Alan and I said, we spent like 3 or 4 days just saying, okay, Neil, what makes Sandman Sandman? What do you think? And I did something similar with Robin Asimov, Isaac's daughter on Foundation.
Yeah, I was going to ask, that's really interesting that you brought that up, because I feel like often as comic book fans, people who love this stuff, comics have been seen since, you know, they first in the 1800s when it was strip comics or whatever, sure, to, you know, the Wortham Trials. They're seen as like lowbrow and disposable. Yeah. They're for kids, you know, that's still something people see. So it's kind of incredible to hear you talking about how adapting comics taught you how to adapt these kind of huge epic sci-fi stories for prestige. Were there any other kind of things that you learned from adapting so many superhero stories and comic books that helped you when it came to adapting something like this that takes place over thousands of years, the way that comics kind of have that modern mythology of going over many, many centuries?
I do think that it's funny if you go to classic comic book storytelling, right? I think comic books are the closest to serialized TV storytelling is almost any other art form, right? Yeah. Because you've got the individual episodes, which are akin to the individual issues. And then you've got these arcs, which would be akin to like the season. And then you've got like the super arc, right? You know?
Yeah.
And so because I spent so much time reading comics as a kid, that's just the way structurally I think. So with regards to Sandman and Foundation, we definitely think about, okay, this is a serialized story, but is each episode, can each episode be a complete meal? And then how does it fit within the season? And is there a beginning, a middle, and an end to the season? And then how does it fit with the super story? That's definitely something I picked up from, you know, Denny O'Neill or Chris Claremont or, you know, Frank Miller or someone like that.
Can I ask you about the
You can ask me anything, Jason. We'll see whether or not I answer.
Since we're on the subject of comics, a few years ago, a letter that you wrote to editor and writer at Marvel, Mark Grunwald, who's then in charge of the Captain America book, emerged. And it was you basically giving notes on a particular storyline and the challenges the character faced in that particular era, the mid-80s, with, you know, Reagan in the White House. Did you always take comics that seriously? And was it in your mind to be a writer at that point? Because surely, I mean, it's not very many people write a, like, 700-word letter to the editor to Marvel Comics.
Yes and yes to both those questions. I mean, I also have a letter in the Alan Moore run of Swamp Thing, American Gothic, which I'm very proud of.
You know?
In which I incorrectly guessed at what was behind all the various sub-monsters that were going after Swamp Thing. But yeah, I probably got about... I will say this, every letter I wrote got printed. I probably have about 7 letters.
Wow. That's a solid run.
Yeah, but I was, you know, growing up in Michigan, going to my local comic book store and I, you know, I don't know, from the time I was about 4th or 5th grade, I thought about, you know, becoming a comic book writer first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And the idea that I would become a screenwriter was just crazy. We didn't know anyone in Hollywood, but a comic writer felt like attainable possibly.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I revered them. I just thought, because I was coming up in the, you know, Teen Titans when that started. Yeah. And I was reading, you know, Byrne and Claremont's Uncanny X-Men while that arc was happening, like in real time. And it was when it was, I think it was bi-monthly. And that was just blowing my mind. That was one of the first ones that really blew my mind, was what was happening with X-Men. And I just thought it was amazing.
Yeah, well, I will say there is a grand tradition. One of my favorite things, I have a lot of back issues, and one of my favorite things to do is read the letters page, because you actually see a lot of letters from people who would go on to write comics.
For sure.
So, George R. R. Martin, and you see a lot of notables.
You can go in there and you'll find letters from, like, big name people, and you'll totally. Be like, oh, okay, you were the fan. You know? So what was it like to then go from being one of those fans and then continue that tradition of actually getting to write comics?
Well, the funny thing is I wrote movies before I wrote comics. Like a lot of people write comics.
Wild?
Yeah, yeah, and they go to write. And then I was, so I had already, you know, was making A Healthy Living. I'd already had Blade come out.
Mm-hmm.
And then randomly I was introduced to James Robinson, who was on the Starman run at the time. Mm-hmm. And we met and we had dinner one night. And he confessed to me that he had writer's block and he was trying to figure out where to go and what to do. And I started pitching some ideas for him. And he said, that's a really good idea. Do you mind if I use that? I said, no, go ahead. And then we had dinner a couple weeks later and he said, you got any more ideas? And then he just said, do you want to start co-plotting it with me? Because I feel bad I'm using so many of these ideas. And so then I did and I co-plotted it with him for a while. And then he said, hey, DC wants to revive the Justice Society. Do you want to just co-write it with me? And I said, sure, that sounds great. And the irony there was James bailed in the second issue. His name is still on like five more issues, but he bailed. He had this sort of crisis of conscience. And I literally, I'd only written like two full scripts. And DC said, well, do you want to keep writing? We like it. And I said, sure, sure, but I need help. And so here's what's really crazy at the time was I was also friendly with Jeff Johns, who had just written, I think he was still like Richard Donner's assistant and had just written, like, I don't even know if Stargirl had come out, but he'd like written a proposal for something. And I said, hey, Jeff, do you want to write this with me? And DC wouldn't, I had to like, really pressure them to approve him to co-write.
You changed the course.
But Jeff started on JSA with me as of like the second issue, and then obviously he became Jeff Johns, you know, with a capital G and a capital J. But I backed into comics in you know just a really weird way, and then you know we kept it up for about 4 years, and then it became too unwieldy for me. But that was, I loved doing it. I would still go back and write comics at some point. I really, really enjoyed doing it. I didn't do the Marvel method though. We wrote full scripts.
Better
to do it the full script way.
So how did you break into screenwriting then? I remember, I've told you this story before, but in 98, I worked in a movie theater, so I saw every single movie that came out in 98. Every single movie that came out that year, I saw in the theaters, including Blade and Dark City, two movies
came
coming
out
the
same
year.
I know.
Crazy.
So how did that happen?
I broke in to movies. Well, basically, the short version is I didn't know anyone in Hollywood, couldn't figure out how to make a path into writing. So I was going to become a cop in Michigan. I was going to become a homicide detective. I was going to get a degree in police administration, go to Michigan State University. And then my high school teachers said, oh my God, you can't do that. You got to write, which I'd wanted to, but I had a single mom. We didn't have much money. And they kind of staged an intervention. They came over to our house for coffee and said, they suggested I apply to USC screenwriting. And my mom said, we cannot afford it. And they said, just, we think he can get in and just get scholarships and whatnot. And so we had enough money with financial aid for me to attend one semester.
Wow.
And I got in and this was an undergraduate degree. And then every semester was sketchy as like whether or not I could keep going. So I worked two or three jobs and I would apply for all these grants, but I made it and I busted my ass and in the program you were meant to come out with one screenplay and I had three by the time I was done. And in my last semester, I thought, oh, I'm going to get an agent. And I remember reading about this particular agent who'd become an agent, I believe at ICM at the time, which is one of the, I think they're defunct now, right?
No, no longer with us.
Yeah,
yes.
They've been absorbed by one of the other mega agencies.
Yeah.
And I read about this guy who had, he'd gone through Berkeley in like 2.5 years and become an agent at 23. And I thought, oh, that guy seems like a real, you know, firecracker. I'm gonna have that guy be my agent. So I started cold calling his office from my dorm room. And I called, I think it was 42 business days. I would say, hey, this is David Goyer. You know, I need to talk to so-and-so. Finally, on like the 42nd day, it became a joke. I was in my dorm room. I was like, what do I care?
Yeah.
And finally, the assistant, he jumps on the line and says, who the fuck are you and why you keep calling me? And I realized that I forgot like 30 seconds. And I said, listen, I'm about to graduate USC Film School. I'm going to be a giant filmmaker one day. You should represent me. You're going to kick yourself if you don't. And there was this pause and he said, okay, send me your script, but don't fucking call me every day. It's going to take me a while. To yeah. So, by the way, I had nothing to lose. I was in my dorm room, like in my underwear. And I waited 2 weeks and then I started calling him again. And for another couple of weeks, finally he answered and he said, I'm going to sign you. And so I got an agent before I even graduated.
Wow.
But what was interesting is he said, and your script's really good, but I decided I was going to sign you even before I read it. And I said, why? And he's because you were so damn tenacious that I just thought this kid's going to succeed. And then I graduated and I got a job as a production assistant on a studio. And it was my job to deliver mail around the lot and also snacks. Like I had like a hand cart with, you know, and I did that for about 4 months. And at the time he said, I thought I was going to write funny, sort of like American Werewolf in London movies. Yeah. And he said, can you write, I think Die Hard had just come out, and he said, can you write an action movie? And so I studied some and I wrote one. And after 4 months, he said, I think I can sell this. And like 2 days later, he sold it. And he sold it to MGM and he sold it for more than 10 times what I was making as my yearly salary as a PA. And he sold it to Jean-Claude Van Damme. and who had just come out with Cyborg. And I hadn't watched any movies anywhere. I remember this. He called me at work. This is before cell phones. And he said, Jean-Claude Van Damme wants to buy your script. Do you know who he is? No. And I could hear him like unfolding the newspaper. And he said, there's a show at like 1:45 at the Chinese Theater on Hollywood Boulevard. Go see it and meet with him at like 5 o'clock. So I feigned sickness. I saw this movie, which is terrible. Then I met with him.
Not his best.
And I met with him, but he was, you know, say what you will about him, but he was effusive. And he said, you're a great writer. And I remember, I can't do a Belgian accent, but he said, I will protect. Yeah. He said, Hollywood will try to destroy you, but I will protect you like an eagle. And they made the movie, and like 2 months later, I was on the set. So I was 22, and it was four or five months out of school. And then I kicked around and did some other Jean-Claude-y movies for a while, and then eventually I got the gig to write Blade, and that was the first time that Mike DeLuca, who was running New Line at the time, and now is running Warner Brothers, just let me write what I want to write, and just didn't give me notes, and so. You know, I guess the proof is in the pudding with that. Another long answer.
That
was a great one.
One great answer. And I love that Jean-Claude Van Damme story. That makes me very happy as someone who is a huge fan of his spin kick.
He'll protect you like an eagle.
I mean, that's the most Jean-Claude Van Damme thing I've ever heard. He's going to protect you like an eagle. Okay, so let's talk about Blade. Because A, it's like a fucking masterpiece.
Yeah.
And B, that essentially establishes the superhero genre for the next, you know, still now. It's still going on because of Blade.
People cite X-Men, the first one, which was great, but Blade came first.
But it's Blade. Yeah. And it's Blade Marvel Studios. First. You know, you have this. So could you talk a little bit about Blade? Like, was that a character you'd come across before? Did you go back and read the black and white stuff? Or was this just a story? I mean, it's such a cool concept that you were just like, I immediately know what this is going to be.
Well, I was a giant comic book geek anyway. So there was almost no Marvel or DC character that I wasn't familiar with. So I had read all of Tomb of Dracula, and I'd read the black and white sort of more mature magazine stories. And I was completely familiar with Blade. And I had heard that New Line wanted to make, they had had some success with House Party and Deep Cover, like so-called urban movies. And I'd heard that they wanted to do a black superhero. And so they were thinking Marvel. And at the time it was Luke Cage, it was Blade, mm-hmm. or it was Black Panther. And I thought Blade could potentially be made for a price because it was a horror film, you know, an action horror film. And I was also really, I was watching a lot of Hong Kong action films at the time, you know, way before they became in vogue. And so I had this crazy idea, like movies like Bride with a White Hair and stuff like that. I had this crazy idea to fuse like Hong Kong action films with, you know, vampire movies with, it was just like, I don't know why I came up with it. And I pitched it. And I pitched a trilogy, I remember, to DeLuca, and I said, I'm going to pitch you the Star Wars of vampire films. And he said, at the time, they wanted to make it for $6 to $8 million. And they liked the pitch, and he just let me write. So the movie that got made is largely the one that I wrote. But the funny thing is, he said $6 to $8 million, and my first draft came in, and they budgeted it, and it came in at $45 million. And it was R-rated. And the crazy thing is, DeLuca, who took these huge risks at the time, just said, screw it, we're going to make it. And then eventually the budget even escalated to $55 million. And people were, Spawn had come out, and people were just making fun of the movie before it came out. I remember reading early chatter, even on like Ain't It Cool way back when.
Yeah.
You know, but I knew what we'd made, and I knew we had the goods. And it was amazing being in those first couple of audience previews, because you could just feel the audience like, oh my God, this is something we've never seen before. It was cool.
Okay, sorry. I just need, Jason, I know we usually have a format. But I need to know about the blood rave, because it is like one of the most iconic sequences ever and is now like constantly spoken about.
It's memed,
And it's memed. And also it's like, you know, the Batman, there's definitely like they have the rave sequence there and it's like definitely red and very themed. Could you just talk about that? Like, because did you know that that was going to become like such an iconic moment?
Well, that, I mean, look, that was in my pitch, was that opening. I mean, I pitched that scene in the old, because I was trying to reinvent vampire movies and vampire stories. And I just thought, what's the most decadent, you know, thing I can possibly think of, you know, a kind of a vampire let them eat cake or something like that. So that was in the first pitch. And then, you know, Steve Norrington did an incredible job shooting it. It was completely miserable. We shot it in Los Angeles and we shot it over the course of like, I can't remember how many days, but it was hot. It was summer. And the crew had to wear those sort of like white hazmat suits, you know, like Breaking Bad, like clean suits.
Yeah.
And it was all this fake blood, and the floor was really sticky, and it smelled awful. I mean, just awful. And you couldn't walk around without your feet sticking to things. And it was, I mean, it was a miserable sequence to film. But I don't know. It's look, we're talking about something that I wrote 27 years ago. We're like, where did I come up with the idea? But I was just trying to come up with breaking down the conventions. I don't get me wrong, I love Hammer House of Horror films, but I was trying to come up with like of the anti, you know, Hammer vampire story.
Yeah.
And also tip into blaxploitation and all of those things. It's crazy that it worked.
Yeah.
You know? Because we're sort of fusing so many different elements.
So you're a writer for a number of years, an increasingly successful writer. You become the go-to guy for adaptation, comic adaptation, IP stuff, as you noted. How do you then make the transition to director and showrunner? And how hard is that to do?
Mm. Good question. Well, at the time when I started to do it, it was very hard because I built up a head of steam as a screenwriter back in the days when one could make a good living as a screenwriter as opposed to what's happening right now. And And I was a fast screenwriter, so I could write 4 feature scripts a year. And I was making a really good living. And I had had the fortunate, well, I would say with Blade and Dark City, those were the first times I'd worked with, you know, genuinely good directors. And I'd worked with some not so good directors prior to that. And I'd seen, one of the things that's hard as a screenwriter is you can have your name on a movie or a teleplay, and up to 30% of it could be rewritten by other people, but they won't get credit. Their names won't appear, but you get the blame if they massively alter. And so I'd had this experience of just either being rewritten by people or worked with some mediocre or bad directors. And I wanted to retain more control. So I wanted to start producing and then eventually directing. And I thought, well, I can at least be a mediocre director. and you know, maybe at the beginning I was. I think I got better at it. And it's the whole 10,000 hour thing. But it's hard because my agents did not want me to do it. They were making money off of me. And
Dave, we got a good thing going.
And people don't want to give a first-time director a shot. So I adapted a book called Zigzag that I had a budget for $2.8 million. And I Wesley agreed to do a cameo. He worked on it for 6 days. He was like the anchor. And then I got some other people like Oliver Platt and Natasha Lyonne and John Leguizamo. And I worked in that movie for a year, and I took what's called scale. So I can't even remember what I made to write it, something like $18,000, and to direct it, $40,000. And $58,000 seems like a lot, but I was making far more than that as a writer. And my agents were not happy with me making the shift.
And how much more complicated, because obviously you've been in this business now so long and seen so many changes, and now you've got productions on TV/streaming that are essentially multi-episode movies. How did you, it seems like a very daunting task to try and put all those tools together and say, now I'm going to manage a multi-episode, multi-season movie that takes place on, one continent, but across the continent in multiple time zones at once. What were the things that you encountered that you were like, well, I'm glad that I had been through these other experiences to let me know how to do this?
Well, first of all, I mean, it is daunting. It is really hard. There are times when I wish I could work on a show that just took place in one city that, in one time zone that didn't have a ton of visual effects or things like that. But it was also kind of bit by bit by bit by bit over the course of 20 years. So it was just building upon what I learned before. And I had, the first show that really made some waves was a show that I had co-created called Flash Forward way back on ABC at the time. And I directed the first 2 episodes of that. And then I had another show on Starz called Da Vinci's Demons, which was a little more ambitious. It's sort of each one was successfully a little more ambitious. And it's just building upon, you look at a lot of people, a lot of filmmakers, and, Chris Nolan started out with, Following, which is most people I haven't even seen or heard of. And then, why am I blanking on
Memento?
Memento, yeah. Then Memento, and then Insomnia, and then he didn't start. He was incredibly talented, but he didn't start out with Inception.
Yeah. So with something that's also like you talk about ambition, and you've already set up this kind of huge challenge for yourself, and then coming into the second season, you arguably switch everything up.
Yeah.
And kind of go 100 years in the future and change like 100 plus and change like a lot of the major cast. Could you talk about those kind of choices and challenges and how that adds to the ambition and the storytelling?
Well, when I pitched Foundation to Apple, I said, this is going to be a crazy hybrid because it's going to be a cross between a serialized show and kind of a seasonal anthology. And so I said, we're going to have like, you know, a complete story, and they're going to be a handful of characters that are going to continue from season to season that are through the various tropes of science fiction are going to be effectively immortal. And then we're going to introduce new characters each season, and they're going to have a complete story and then, you know, either succeed or die or whatnot. And then they won't come back. And I couldn't really think of a show that had pursued that format before. And I thought it would be an interesting way to kind of tackle some of the more anthological aspects of Foundation. And I guess Apple was crazy enough to go for it, you know? I mean, normally when you pitch something that just like breaks all the conventional rules of storytelling or storytelling as it's known on streaming, you're like, oh, you're crazy. That'll never fly. And on top of it, be hugely expensive. But there were some fans at Apple of Foundation, and that helped. And I, you know, at the time I created it with Josh Friedman, who left after the third episode or so. But you know, we spent a lot of time on that pitch, and each of us had, you know, had a certain body of work that we'd worked on prior to that. That I guess they, you know, bought our crazy pitch. You know, I think that in terms of changing it up, I think on one hand, what we did with season two, you could say you're crazy to have attempted that. Like, why not continue what you know, why are you just doing a refresh on everything? But people seem to have really, you know, gone nuts for it. And so I just felt like it would be boring if we repeated ourselves, or boring if we just, yeah. I just wanted to try something really bold and challenging. And I'm kind of amazed at how well season two has been received. I thought more people would be freaked out by the fact that we're just jumping forward 130 years and just introducing a whole slew of new characters. And even many of the characters that, you know, are, you know, we're perceiving them in a different way. And I love how we just start with the first episode and we just plunk you in the middle of this black and white film, you know, with Harry Seldon. And we just say, you got to catch up. Sorry. You know, I don't know. That excited me. And I am amazed, though, that it didn't throw more people, I will say.
That opening scene where Harry is trying to knit his mind back together.
Yeah.
How much of that was written? How much of that is Jared just kind of going?
About half. So we wrote some stuff. I will say this: it's not all random. Well, because you've seen this season, like some of the stuff that he says loops back around, and people will go, "Oh, interesting." Jared's a really smart, shrewd guy, and we talked about the themes of things that he could talk about. So he said everything that was scripted, and then it was just kind of an open mic. Let her rip, stream of consciousness. I mean, honestly, I would have gone on longer, but that stuff is also really expensive because whether it's the black and white stuff where we're trying to erase things, or whether it's the stuff in the Prime Radiant itself where we're trying to erase crude reflections, it's there were times when he said a bunch of stuff and he said, oh, you're not going to use that. You're not going to use that. You're not going to use that. And we then ended up using a lot of it.
Of course. And then you get that juxtaposition with that like incredible action sequence.
Oh my God.
Lee naked fighting the assassins. And that's like a very different tone shift too. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because the action's so great.
You know, I loved juxtaposing those two scenes together, though, because there's like one is as heady, kind of art filmy, you know, THX 1138 as you can get. And then the other one is just kind of a Game of Thrones action sequence. But I wanted to challenge the audience and challenge people's expectations of what, if they'd seen season one, or even if they hadn't seen season one and they'd heard about it, what kind of scenes we could take on in the show. Because I think there was some people had heard about it but maybe there was a barrier to entry because they thought it was like too highbrow or too heady or
cerebral.
Too, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And it is still cerebral, but I thought it's a big tent and we can embody a bunch of scenes. And I'm excited with, you know, I don't know when this episode is going to drop, but episode 2 will drop the 21st.
Yeah.
And we also start to introduce some more elements and some more dry humor as of episode 2 and particularly with episode 3. And once again, I'm excited for the audience to, you know, on the surface of it, it feels like it wouldn't work, but it does work. And mm-hmm. you realize it's also such, Foundation is so serious that it's good to have some characters that don't take psychohistory seriously or the Empire seriously. It's good to have characters like that kind of in your quiver.
Yeah.
Well, David, this has been such a fun conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
My pleasure. And if I can do a tiny plug.
Yes, please.
Please.
I've got a little website that I've neglected for a while, but I've also because of the strike and stuff, davidescore.com. I'm doing show notes as episodes drop. And I'm also including kind of behind the scenes making of photos and things. And so if people want to log on to there and I'm going to put together a mailing list, they can get some more sort of fun behind the scenes details. And that's all I got.
Cool.
That's awesome. Thanks again, David.
My pleasure.
Up next, Nerd Out.
In today's Nerd Out, where you tell us what you love and why, a theory you're excited to share, or a quick question we can answer, Matt offers a thought on Indiana Jones. Matt begins with some kind words towards us. Thank you, Matt. I won't make everyone listen to them, but we appreciate you. Matt says, with Indiana Jones back in the limelight, I wanted to share a realization I had during the last time I watched Raiders of the Lost Ark. Throughout the introductory sequence, walking through the Peruvian woods, encountering bats, double-crossing aides, outsmarting traps, shrugging off scary wildlife, even taking a gorgeous relic and surviving a collapsing tomb, many exclamation points. There is not so much as a hint of the legendary John Williams theme. It's only when Indy grabs the vine to swing into the water and escape his pursuers that we hear those trumpets blare out his motif. That got me reflecting on how the heart of Indy is truly the escape. He doesn't get to keep the Ark at the end of Raiders, or the Shankara stones at the end of Temple of the Doom, or the Grail at the end of the Crusade, or the skull at the end of Kingdom. I haven't seen Dial of Destiny yet, but I kind of hope it keeps to this tradition of Indy getting into something way over his hat and just making it out by the skin of his teeth, because that's who Indiana Jones is. The ultimate fuck around and find out hero. Thank you for indulging my observation, sending you all the love in this nerd's heart, Matt. Thank you, Matt. I think that's true. I think it's all about the escape.
I think that's true.
It's about the close calls.
It is about that. I've been thinking about something we talked about during our conversation about Indy, and that's how in the final act of most of these movies, the agency goes to a higher power, God, aliens, mm-hmm. whatever, and it's actually not Indy kind of doing whatever the big thing is at the very end of the movie. And I was thinking about it, and I think you know, to Matt's point, not only is it about the escape, but what makes Indy the hero in these stories is the mm-hmm. fact that he is able to put whatever the object and the power behind the object is in the correct framing. He understands, like, I'm just a man. I'm not going to fuck around with God. Like, I'm not even going to I'm not going to mess with that. Right. Like, he has that respect, and all the other villains of our various pieces, mostly Nazis, never do, right? They mm-hmm. always want to say, well, I want to seize God's or an alien's power for myself. Indy never does that. And number two, you know, kind of attaching this observation to Matt's observation, part of the reason it's about the escape for Indy is, think about it, he can only go for objects that he can carry out in a medium-sized duffel bag. That's it.
It has to fit in a satchel, or else it's not happening to him.
It's not happening, folks. He's got to be able to tuck it into like a postman's bag and climb out. So it is often about the escape, because who's going to help him carry the thing out of there?
Mm-hmm.
How is he gonna get the Ark, like, out of Tannis and out of the building? Like, I guess they were gonna have a truck or something, but there was no way that was ever gonna happen.
Thanks, Matt. If you have theories, passions, or quick questions you want to share, hit us up at xray@crooked.com. Instructions in the show notes.
A huge thanks to David S. Goyer for being so generous with his time this episode. And that's it for us this episode. Rosie, any plugs?
Yes, I'm going to plug Mutual Aid. It's very hot out there. So on Saturday, when I was leaving San Diego, I went to CVS. I bought $28 of water, which was like six big cases of water. And I just handed it out to all the folks who live in San Diego year round. If you were at San Diego, there are loads of great mutual aid organizations there that you can donate to if you weren't able to be there and help out the folks when you were actually at the con because you were busy. There's a great one called We All We Got SD. That's their Instagram handle. Also, if you have a freezer that is big and you live in America, maybe because a lot of the freezers here are really big, put a case of water in your freezer. Then when you're driving around, if you see anyone just sitting out in the sun, you can just give them an icy bottle of water. Cold water saves people's lives in these heat waves. And if you can't and don't have the time or aren't physically able, there's loads of great spaces, homemade meals, community fridges. There's loads of different places that you can do it. But right now it's really hot and being outside is really dangerous. So cold water is a great thing to have in your fridge, or just throw some cash to one of the mutual aid orgs in your area.
Well said. Catch the next episode of X-Ray Vision Friday, July 28th for the finale of Secret Invasion. We'll be there.
Yeah, Secret Invasion. It's the final episode. It's time. It's happened. You can watch full episodes of the podcast on YouTube and check out our Twitter at XRVPod and our Discord to hang out with all those cool fans we're always talking about.
5-star ratings, 5-star reviews. We need them. We got to have them. You got to give them to us. Here is one from Ash. It's the only podcast I prioritize listening to. Wow. If you care about any nerd stuff at all, this is the podcast for you. I've been a loyal listener since episode one, and I love the show so much. I even joined the Discord, something I'd never done before. Welcome, Ash.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
X-Ray Vision is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Chris Lord and Saul Rubin and executive produced by me, Jason Concepcion. Our editing and sound design is by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Video production by Dylan Villanueva and Rachel Gajewski. Social media by Awa Okolati and Caroline Dunphy. Thank you to Brian Vasquez for our theme music.
See you next time.
Bye.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union, a savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like,
whoa.
And, not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.